Some critics on the left perceive a new world overclass more loyal to each other than to their fellow citizens. Resentment of this cosmopolitan elite played a major part in the victory of Donald J. Trump in the 2016 presidential election. But, in contrast to the River Rouge model, the interdependence of many key industries on international supply chains is likely to frustrate economic nationalism. By the 1990s, management theorists were revising long-standing assumptions about the nature of the corporation. In 1989, the Harvard Business School economist Michael C. Jensen foresaw the demise of the public corporation. During the previous decade, he and other academics had trained a generation of elite consultants and executives to regard return to shareholders as the sole purpose of business, a break from older views that balanced investor interests with those of employees, customers, and the public. The agency theory promoted by Jensen and his colleagues had already bestowed an Ivy League pedigree on the corporate raiders and dismantlers, who could portray themselves as efficient reallocators of assets and foes of transaction costs. The promise of compensating executives for their true contribution to shareholder income never realized its potential. There were too many ways for executives to manipulate results with creative accounting, often increasing their compensation even in bad years. As predicted by Campbell's Law, the criterion of measured profits can be manipulated to give a false idea of what they are supposed to measure, long-term benefits to shareholders. By 2014, hundreds of companies were using non-standard accounting methods to justify executive bonuses. Agency theory, designed to reduce conflicts between executives' and shareholders' interests, may increase them in the long run. A second wave began with the internet boom of the 1990s. Another Harvard Business School professor, Clayton Christensen, began a new phase of thinking about technological change when he coined the phrase disruptive innovation in a paper he co-authored with a senior Harvard colleague, Joseph L. Bauer, in the Harvard Business Review in 1995. Christensen's own innovation was to question the conventional business wisdom of listening to customers and giving them what they ask for. New and revolutionary technology is often inferior to established methods. At first, it appeals not to existing users, but to buyers with different backgrounds and needs. Only with time and further refinement does it compete with and eventually dominate conventional products. Bauer and Christensen cited the computer disk drive industry, in which established firms scorned new compact formats with initially reduced storage capacity, drives that ultimately made the mini and microcomputer industries possible. That segment may not have been the best example. Few of the original manufacturers survived, but Seagate, which Bauer and Christensen singled out, had emerged as one of the most dominant and best-managed companies in the global drive industry by the early 21st century. Disruption, however, can be very real. Since the mid-1990s, the most striking example has been Eastman Kodak's failure to compete with its dominant film products by developing the digital technology of its own laboratories. Around the time Christensen's The Innovator's Dilemma appeared, a new business form was emerging, one that could challenge even earlier disruptive companies, the platform. Under continuous process efficiency, the point was production of material goods, their retail distribution, and speedy freight and personal transportation. Platform entrepreneurship, which began not with the personal computer, but with the World Wide Web and its graphic browsers in the 1990s, is different. A platform is a web-based service that provides a framework for other services or transactions. Economists had long believed that the firm, with all its overhead and bureaucracy, was a necessary institution for reducing transaction costs. But what if technology could match exchanges of goods and services? That idea appears to date from an academic book that appeared in 1996, Invisible Engines, How Software Platforms Drive Innovation and Transform Industries. The platform company may combine the functions of commission sales, advertising, and information brokerage. It may be a de facto employment agency or taxicab company. Its attraction is that it centralizes information and services that otherwise would require searches and a multiplicity of sites. It can organize these as streams of feeds and suggestions and turn the user's behavior online into information that can be marketed to third parties. Best of all for investors, it can even induce users to do nearly all the work. A platform company may manufacture and distribute goods of its own. Microsoft, IBM, and especially Apple still sell billions in hardware. But the greatest room for growth appears elsewhere, getting paid by other businesses and by individuals to improve the efficiency of transactions. It was not only the well-known exponential growth of processor speed and storage that made software revolutionary. It was a small number of ingenious ideas that reduced the need for brute force, techniques like error-correcting codes, without which online commerce and communication would collapse, data compression, which multiplies storage capacity, and public key cryptography, which, built into web browsers and server software, makes secure internet sessions possible. These ideas multiplied the efficiency of hardware. Brilliant computational shortcuts could be the equivalent of massive hardware and its brute force. They are concepts for solving a problem in the speediest possible way, ideas that can be expressed in code. Take the numbering systems of product codes, the basis of electronic commerce, and, as applied to books, one of the foundations of Amazon.com in the 1990s. It was worked out by a Dutch mathematician named Jacobus Verhoef, and is a formula for adding an additional digit to a number. This number, which you may have seen preceded by a dash in non-book product codes as well, has no significance in itself. Called a check digit, it is there only to allow a computer program to verify the real number by processing it with a complex formula that results in a single-digit answer. If that number does not match the check digit, for example, because the customer mistakenly transposed two digits, an error notice appears. Few people entering numbers ever think about how they are generated and checked. That is the beauty of the algorithm, but also a pity, because it lets us take the economic power of mathematics for granted. We have all heard of Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon.com. Only technical specialists and historians have heard of Jacobus Verhoef. Yet when Bezos planned to transform online retailing, bookselling was a natural beginning because, thanks to Verhoef's algorithm, more books had standardized product numbers than any other category of merchandise. Likewise, until recently, few lay people knew the name of Karl-Heinz Brandenburg, or the other German and American computer scientists who, in the late 1980s and 1990s, developed MP3 and other music compression algorithms that made possible the efficient use of digital storage in devices like Steve Jobs' iPod. The recorded music industry, complacently selling for $16.98, compact discs costing less than a dollar to manufacture, was memorably disrupted. When added to massive storage in remote computers over the internet, efficient algorithms make possible a new style of quantitative analysis that has come to be known as big data. In the age of the slide rule and the punch card, people also felt overwhelmed by data, and early business education was based in part on techniques for analyzing it. But the ability to store and analyze unprecedented records was not just a more powerful version of the statistical thinking of the continuous process era. It has allowed far more precise identification of the productivity and profitability of employees and the value of customers. Michael Lewis's best-selling book, Moneyball, 2003, implied that any manager could emulate the Oakland A's general manager Billy Beane in identifying more sophisticated measurements of prospective employees' contributions. The problem of big data is that competitors usually have access to similar datasets and algorithms, so competitive advantages are similar to what accountants call wasting assets, tools, machinery, and other objects that lose their value over time, and techniques need constant refinement. Platform companies accumulate such enormous volumes of data that, unlike athletic teams, they become difficult to dislodge from first place. They also have the ability, as the political economist William Davies has observed, to follow and possibly manipulate trends in public sentiment without public scrutiny. 19th-century statistics were, to a great extent, a public institution. 21st-century post-statistical big data are becoming a proprietary tool. As judges today privilege findings of secret algorithms, courts undermine the competitive advocacy testing of disputed evidence essential to criminal and civil justice. A foundation of much big data, in turn, is user-generated information. Gathering and entering data can be hard work, as in polling and focus groups. Platform efficiency is based in part on encouraging customers to create data without pay. Amazon's customer rating system was the best-known early version of the idea. An even deeper revolution was the Google PageRank algorithm, which, unlike earlier search software, relied on relationships between the links that countless website owners chose. Scientific bibliographers, like the information scientist Eugene Garfield, had pioneered using the citations in scientific papers to point to the works that had been most influential and thus presumably of highest quality and interest. The founders of Google, the computer science graduate students Larry Page and Sergey Brin, extended this idea beyond science to the entire World Wide Web. We will hear more about it in Chapter 2. Despite acknowledged problems and the need to revise the algorithm constantly against manipulation, the relevance and quality of results soon exceeded those of all rivals. A corollary has been user classification. Systematizing authorities of the 19th and early 20th centuries were still trying to create a single hierarchic order of knowledge. 21st century readers and even some professional librarians now pay more attention to tags, keywords that may be proposed by lay readers, rather than classification specialists. The Princeton, New Jersey Public Library, for example, still uses the Dewey Decimal System, but shelves nonfiction books, like technology studies, in subject neighborhoods drawn from different Dewey ranges. Despite the growing importance of feeds from social media and anxiety that Facebook and Twitter have become default information sources, search does not seem to have declined as an information habit in managing the explosion of data. While Google does not publish its annual number of searches, a search industry site interprets its statements to mean that searches increased by over 50% from 2012 to 2016 alone, now exceeding 2 trillion annually, 15% of which have been for keywords never previously searched. Social media might replace some web surfing, but they also seem to be generating even more searches. Since 2012, when he co-authored a paper tracking the flow of information into the home, the communication scholar W. Russell Newman and his colleagues have been giving new life to an old distinction in their field. Information push, in Newman's terms, is dissemination by influential media in the days of relative information scarcity. Information pull is users' preference for getting media products on demand, whether through search or streaming services. Google and other modern search engines made it possible to use information more actively, to request it specifically, rather than receive it from a limited number of outlets. Information pull, in turn, helps to create another defining feature of platform efficiency, personalization. Industrial age mass media put a premium on typical consumers subdivided by broad demographic categories like age, gender, geography, and estimated income. There were also mailing lists of people with special interests, enthusiast buyers of books on cacti and succulents, for example, but these were expensive to rent and not always up to date. The big data of online retailers and search engine companies could identify tastes and predict behavior more accurately and at a lower cost. Platform colossi like Google and Facebook have thus become the most lucrative advertising agencies in history. Users of Google will note how often they are served advertising not only from the company they were originally looking for, but from its competitors, an opportunity no print or broadcast medium can offer. Thanks to such power, from the time of its initial public offering in 2005 to the calendar year 2016, Google's advertising revenue grew by over 1,000%, from $6.07 billion to $79.38 billion. For some corporations, the platform idea offers another strategy opportunity, dematerialization. Technology companies originally built on distribution of physical products, especially IBM and Apple, have been shifting to web-based services. Amazon.com now makes more profit from its web services than from its retail operations. Personalization and cloud-based services have been made even more popular by the spectacular rise of mobile computing after many false starts in the decade after 1995. The adoption rate of smartphones after the introduction of the iPhone has been one of the most rapid in the history of information technology. It took over a quarter century from the introduction of the Apple I computer in 1976 for the household acquisition of personal computers to grow to about 60% in 2003. That level was reached in only 8 years from the introduction of the iPhone in 2007 to 2015, mostly in the midst of a historic recession. In fact, economic hardship may have helped promote the technology. Smartphones and their apps have become the primary gateway to the web for almost 20% of Americans, especially low-income and young people. Thus, both for better and for worse, many web resources are optimized for the personal, mobile, small screen rather than for the office or home monitor. Social scientists were quick to recognize the potential of this trend. Even before the iPhone's introduction, the psychologist Sherry Turkle described the new mobile ethos as always on, always on you. For platform companies and advertisers, the ability to reach consumers based on their real-time location has been a fantasy come true, despite consumers' option of disabling disclosure of their coordinates. Platforms are one of history's most efficient types of business enterprise because they need so few employees and can be even flatter and leaner than other organizations thanks to artificial intelligence. Facebook, with $28 billion in revenue in 2015, had a staff of only about 17,048. With a net income of $10 billion in the same year, it was earning over $586,000 per employee. The classic 20th century technology corporation, IBM, still slightly surpassed it, with consolidated net income from continuing operations of $11.9 billion. But with about 414,000 employees in 2017, that amounts to about $28,700 per employee. For all the prowess of IBM's supercomputer Watson, there is far more profit in using algorithms to gather information from user-generated data and in analyzing it to target advertising to consumers than there is in selling advanced services to corporations. Ubiquitous computing has created new categories of place-based efficiency that take advantage of the global positioning system, GPS, built into smartphones. As platform companies, Uber, Lyft, and others do not own taxis or limousines or employ drivers. They sell their services as super-efficient intermediaries matching customers and driver owners with algorithms that track location and adjust prices to demand. In practice, Uber can assure customers in large cities that they can get a ride at a price within 5 minutes, regardless of weather, traffic conditions, or special events. Uber may thus be the most rapid success of a consumer platform efficiency company. And while many objections have been made to it, especially in Europe, it is indeed efficient, according to economists who have studied its operations. For many city dwellers, even surge pricing is cheaper than paying for, maintaining, and insuring a car. Whatever else can be said about the company and about the ethics of its policies toward its own drivers and its competitors, it is highly efficient in matching riders and drivers. In early 2017, at least, its rates, below cost in many locations, were significantly less than what its customers would have been willing to pay, according to a study by the economist Stephen Levitt, with the company's data and cooperation. Levitt determined that customers who spent $4 billion on Uber rides in 2015 would have been willing to pay $11 billion more, yielding $7 billion for society as consumer surplus, an economist's dream, according to Levitt's co-author, Stephen J. Dubner. Buoyed by such statistics, private investors have embraced the platform economy so fervently that in February 2017, Uber's market capitalization of $62.5 billion exceeded the $49.9 billion valuation of Ford Motor Company, River Rouge plant and all. Despite allegations of misconduct by executives, the company's value had increased to almost $70 billion when a new CEO took office in late August 2017. Uber's business model, like that of many smaller platform companies, is based in part on the ambiguity of American labor and tax laws. When a person is an employee, following directions and thus subject to minimum wage laws and employer tax and insurance contributions, and when he or she is an independent contractor, is often unclear. Software lets Uber take advantage of that ambiguity by combining elements of independence, freedom to set one's own hours and use competing dispatching services, with incentives that can amount to soft direction, a technique known as choice architecture. The most common objections to services like Uber is that they have used lobbying power to gain unfair advantages over existing services by changing regulations, and that surge pricing is yet another way for the rich to jump to the head of the queue. But the real problem may be that it is not a radical innovation at all, and thus does not do much to create a more efficient society, for example, by making trips unnecessary, rather than matching drivers and passengers more expeditiously. We will look at the effects of ride-sharing programs in Chapter 4. The first objection to platform efficiency is in fact that it is not deeply disruptive at all. And this criticism has been made most strongly, not by Silicon Valley's progressive critics, but by the academic most closely identified with the idea of disruption, Clayton Christensen himself. Christensen and his colleagues Derek Van Beaver and Brian Mesway have recently distinguished two kinds of disruption: efficiency innovation and market-creating innovation. One makes existing goods and services available to more people at lower prices. Uber's goal is different, to make transportation constantly available at a market-clearing price that may be lower or higher than conventional companies' charges, but it follows the efficiency pattern. Efficiency innovations often eliminate jobs. Market-creating innovations introduce new categories of products and create jobs. To use the Christensen-Van Beever-Mezway analysis, the bicycle design, introduced in the 1890s and still prevailing today, was not just a faster or less expensive machine than its mid-century predecessors. It redefined and stabilized a new technology in a way that extended its reach in society by orders of magnitude. The most popular earlier bicycles were the so-called penny farthings, with one enormous wheel directly below the rider and a smaller trailing wheel. While the big wheel's diameter minimized jolts on the still unpaved roads of the era, it also risked serious injury to riders who pitched forward when the wheel struck an obstacle. These spills, called headers, actually appealed to many of the youthful and affluent male risk-takers who were the earliest cyclists. In the new safety bicycle, the combination of diamond frame, pneumatic tires, and ball bearings made riding not only safer, less costly, and more comfortable, but actually faster than earlier models, winning over macho racers along with women, the middle-aged, the elderly, and better-paid industrial workers and craftspeople. In the late maturity of the continuous process era in 1960, another market-creating innovation was the Xerox 914 photocopier, which was not just a neater substitute for wet processing photostats, but a device that could sometimes make duplicates of higher quality than the originals. It also rendered Edison-era mimeographs and spirit duplicators obsolete and launched one of the companies with the highest rate of return on capital in history. A $10,000 investment in the company in 1960 would have grown to $1 million by 1972. By contrast, an Uber or Lyft vehicle is, apart from the operator's smartphone, like that of a conventional black car service. Yet the primacy of immediate needs means that more challenging technological innovations are underfunded, even though they might make society as a whole more efficient. For example, improved storage batteries that would simplify the use of renewable energy and extend the range and efficiency of electric cars. The sense of military emergency that promoted government spending on basic research during the Cold War has declined, and climate change has become a partisan issue. Physico-chemical systems present more challenges and constraints than electronic networks and logic. Making efficient devices may take years of apparently wasteful experimentation. Examining the development of U.S. jet engines after World War II, the historian of technology, Philip Scranton, has concluded their success reflected not scientific program management, but nonlinear, irrational, uncertain, multilateral, and profoundly passionate technological and business practice, yielding success not through planning, but through dogged determination, a certain indifference to failure, which secrecy aided, and massive expenditures of public funds. Yet the result has been not only a leap in the speed of civil air transportation, but enhanced reliability and reduction of costs per passenger mile compared to piston engine craft. Before its explosive growth in the 1960s, the Xerox Corporation also had a prolonged and difficult childhood. Two decades of research and development by a small photographic supply company in Eastman Kodak's shadow, Haloid, it was later renamed after its breakthrough, Xerography, were needed before the inventor Chester Carlson's dry photographic process patent of 1938 could be transformed into a commercially successful device. High-temperature fusing of toner to paper made fires a recurrent threat. At one point, prototypes would catch fire if a copied document had too many zeros and letter O's. A small fire, fortunately unnoticed by customers, broke out at a major trade show as late as 1960. Even now, lithium-ion batteries, the most efficient type, can be a hazard. In autumn 2016, the Korean electronics giant Samsung recalled millions of its flagship Note 7 smartphones after hundreds of incidents of fires caused by faulty batteries from two different suppliers. Users of premium electronics demand both compactness and full-day power reserves, but lithium-ion batteries, the only ones that can meet these requirements, use flammable electrolytes. As The Economist put it, catching fire if something goes wrong is their nature. The first problem of platform efficiency, then, is that it promises faster returns than market-creating innovation can, in large part because algorithms can be tested and applied to larger systems at a pace exceeding those of physico-chemical innovations. Programs can now learn rapidly from experience, defeating top professionals not only in games like chess and Go, but in contests like No Limit Texas Hold'em Poker, in which an AI program developed at Carnegie Mellon University took $1.8 million against top-ranking players. Software and hardware advances are, of course, not completely distinct. Modern lithium-ion batteries, for example, need sophisticated programmed controls for safe operation. But the relative difficulty of market-creating innovation is not likely to go away. This disparity helps explain why, in the midst of dazzling improvements in software, the economy rebounded more slowly after the recession of 2008 than after previous 20th century crises. There is a second problem of the new efficiency of financial transactions. Far from reducing the social overhead represented by finance, it has paradoxically increased it. Readers of 1990s Silicon Valley manifestos like The Road Ahead, 1995, by Bill Gates, Nathan Myhrvold, and Peter Ranierson believed they were looking forward to friction-free commerce, in the author's famous phrase. In fact, for their users, Amazon.com and other advanced retail sites have taken much of the work out of buying. Owners of Amazon's Echo voice recognition microphone speaker can use the company's Alexa system to place orders without even having to tap on a screen. Microsoft, Google, and Apple have launched similar electronic assistants. And the efficiency-minded who do want to touch something can opt for one of Amazon's Wi-Fi-enabled buttons that can be attached to appliances for placing instant orders for relevant branded supplies, like detergent for a washing machine. Researchers at the microprocessor colossus Intel predicted in 2009 that by the year 2020, consumers might place their orders just by thoughts picked up by sensors implanted in their brains. While the chipmaker seems to have let that project drop quietly during the recession, it is unlikely to disappear. Friction, nonetheless, has a way of coming in the back door and reversing at least some part of efficiency. Amazon.com hosts 2 million third-party merchants whose offerings are presented along with Amazon's own. Some orders from them are fulfilled through Amazon's own warehouses. Others are shipped directly from the vendors. Vendors may have different warranty policies for the same merchandise and varying consumer ratings and delivery times. Furthermore, they use specially developed software to adjust their prices to those of other Amazon and non-Amazon vendors. Under dynamic pricing, quotations may change without notice. Amazon uses a complex and secret algorithm to select the default vendor in the buy box, the link that adds the item to the consumer's shopping cart. The algorithm also lists other vendors below the winning one. Still others are visible to customers who click yet another button. Amazon vendors use special software to calculate their prices. It might set a higher or lower price. So far, these variations have been minor annoyances compared to the generally rock-bottom prices, convenience of ordering, the Amazon interface is exceptionally well-designed, and speed of delivery in the Prime program. Amazon's competitive power has helped reduce inflation. In fact, Amazon's margins on sales are so small that, as we have noted, its real profit comes from web services it provides to other companies and governments. The unanswered question is whether major acquisitions may turn Amazon into a different kind of company, anti rather than pro-competitive. Thus, the consumer is blessed with the full efficiency of Amazon if, and only if, he or she is willing to accept the choice that Amazon's algorithm, wrestling with the competing algorithms of various vendors with different satisfaction ratings, has decreed. A consumer looking for the lowest price may have to invest more time in considering the full list and weighing vendors' reputations. The memorably named website CamelCamelCamel.com lets buyers review Amazon price histories spike by spike and dip by dip and set up an email for notification when a price drops to a preset level. But that requires additional time for decisions about trigger prices. It is useful mainly for expensive discretionary goods, especially consumer electronics, subject to brief seasonal manufacturers' price breaks. With or without such tools, what began as a simple and highly efficient system for shopping has become a complex one, in which the best offers can appear and disappear suddenly, depending on the dueling calculations of rival algorithms and platform vendors' surveillance of one's buying patterns. Likewise, online travel services originally appeared to simplify decisions by comparing the best hotel prices, but have given rise to a new level of aggregators like Kayak.com, which claims to find the best offers from other booking sites, though hotels have countered by offering their lowest prices for direct reservations. The complexity of booking travel has had an unexpected side effect, a revival of travel agencies, once mortally threatened by web booking. Evaluating customer ratings on web goods and service sites and on social media has also become more complex. According to the New York Times, marketing researchers who have compared Amazon customer reviews with both professional consumer organization reports and resale value have found that user comments are unreliable guides to quality. In practice, it is almost impossible for comparison site owners to screen out shills. In 2012, an academic data mining scholar estimated that fully a third of online reviews were faked. One publishing entrepreneur was briefly making $28,000 a month writing Amazon reviews for self-published authors. At the local level, looking for a computer repair shop, I noticed that one had exclusively five-star reviews with similar syntax, raising questions about the customer's identities. There were no signs of authenticity, such as an occasional mild criticism. None of the reviewers had commented on any other kind of establishment. Other review genres, especially of apartment complexes, conversely seem devoted to the airing of consumer grievances. To make matters even more complicated, some genuine online reviewers of books appear sincerely positive about almost everything. The central problem, though, is that reviews are subject to social influence bias, bandwagon effects, and ratings bubbles. Fake reviews can be surprisingly influential in producing cascades of genuine positive ones. Favorable or not, reviews display the workings of Campbell's Law. Their influence reflects reviewer behavior, making it necessary to discount reviewer bias. Social scientists and webmasters create algorithms to separate real from faked reviews, but these efforts encounter an age-old problem. As in document and fine art appraisal, the very tools developed to detect fraud can be used to commit it more ingeniously. In the end, it's not that customer reviews are useless, but they are much less time-efficient than they at first appeared. It often takes significant time to read through them and find the pros and cons of each product or service. Professional book and product reviewers did limit consumer information, but if you trusted their judgment, it was more efficient to follow it than to try to divine the wisdom of the crowd. It is also not clear whether the platform economy of online retailing is more efficient than that of conventional stores. There has been a plausible argument that it reduces greenhouse emissions when compared to conventional bricks-and-mortar shopping by reducing automobile trips. In principle, parcels ordered on the web and delivered to the consumer's door result in lower carbon emissions than multiple shopping trips. Amazon, at least in 2012, claimed a greener shopping experience through the efficiencies of online shopping on its website. In reality, the results of algorithmic efficiency become almost impossible to measure once they begin interacting with human behavior. People diligent about reducing their carbon footprint can indeed save trips and time. But evidence from a study in Delaware suggests that others may compensate for their time and mileage savings with other types of trips, for example, for entertainment. The efficiency of rapid gratification, down to hours rather than merely overnight with some services, also means that more items are shipped and delivered in separate packaging to consumers, goods that when shipped to retailers may be bundled by the dozen on shrink-wrapped pallets instead of individually boxed. Just as electronic inventory control has made possible leaner manufacturing, some consumers are making last-minute purchases, enabled with smartphone apps, a way of life. "Planning ahead is dead," announced an essay by a proudly unorganized writer. Amazon's heavily promoted Prime program offers, in exchange for an annual fee, free 2-day delivery of many of its products, encouraging impulse orders. One form of efficiency, swift delivery, conflicts with another, the savings of combined shipments that were apparent to consumers in the era of the Sears Roebuck catalog. While the cardboard industry has been a leader in recycling, sales of boxes have been growing rapidly as a result of the convenience of online ordering, and recycling has its own environmental costs in shipping. What began in the 1990s as an environmentally efficient concept now is a tangle of unanswered questions, and brands like Amazon and Microsoft have been opening bricks-and-mortar outlets. Turning from retailing to banking and investments, we would expect two things. First, finance would be a lower proportion of the economy as measured by GDP. Surely, credit cards, online banking, smartphone payments, and other innovations, especially the decline of the cost of processing transactions, plus bank mergers, would be expected to reduce finance's share just as changes in seed, fertilizer, and harvesting equipment have reduced that of farming. Second, with more efficient financial means of assessing new ventures, and with an apparently endless stream of innovations announced in scientific journals and magazines, the number of startups should be increasing during recovery from the 2008 financial crisis and recession. Unfortunately, the reverse is true in each case. The first prediction, a declining cost of financial services to society, has not been realized. I call it a prediction only retrospectively. The popular futurist books of the 1960s and 1970s, for all their enthusiasm about computing and automation, do not seem to say much about financial technology. The economist Thomas Philippon has called attention to the growing share of financial sector costs in the GDP, observing that they are now significantly higher than in the days of J.P. Morgan. Around 1910, the financial sector consumed about 4% of GDP. In 2014, that proportion had more than doubled to 9%. The rise has not been steady. There was an initial climb in the 1920s and a drop in the Great Depression through the early post-war years, and then another steep rise from 1970. This tendency has contrasted with trends in other industries that adopted new information technology on a large scale, especially retailing, with its scanners and precise inventory control. Why has the financial system not been more like Walmart? Philippon has wondered. The share of retail and wholesale distribution both dropped during adoption of new information technology. There are two explanations for the difference. The immediate one is that financial institutions have been using the efficiency of lower information and processing costs and that of algorithms to trade more often in the hope of higher profits. In 2011, Philippon reports there were $700 trillion in derivatives, securities based on the value of underlying assets or other financial data in force. Foreign exchange trading volume has increased 200-fold since 1977. There is also no evidence that the increase of trading volume has enhanced the classic goals of financial intermediation: more accurate prices of investments and more efficient management of risk. Trading mechanisms may not have created the financial crisis and recession of 2008, but they did nothing to prevent it. Nor did the recession change the pattern of inefficiency through hyper-efficiency. In 2016, the New York Times reported that a Royal Bank of Canada study had determined that a single security could have as many as 800 prices in 12 different markets. One electronic trader complained that the level of complexity has grown to such an extent that it is unknown to most market participants. Instead of finding natural buyers and sellers, we're finding intermediaries who come in and are benefiting from the complexity. Others lamented that it is impossible to know the price at which an order will be executed, and that the software updates required by the financial system's complexity can lead to potentially ruinous breakdowns, as the trading company Knight Capital experienced in 2012. A market-making newcomer, IEX, has claimed to restore fairness to transactions with a minute delay that will neutralize the advantage of traders working with the fastest algorithms. But the other existing 12 exchanges have argued in opposing it that adding it as a 13th recognized exchange will only make the financial system more complex without the claimed benefit to the independent investor. Such reform proposals, whether or not effective, are symptoms of a trend that is still not completely understood. It is not clear why banks and other organizations and individuals have embraced the high-frequency trading as much as they have, or why buy-and-hold policies fell out of favor. Technological innovations like trading algorithms alone rarely transform society. There must be a cultural change, a latent demand for the innovation. Eastman Kodak and other major corporations declined to finance Chester Carlson's xerography patent because they saw the market as limited to the replacement of wet process document copying. They did not realize how many people would want to copy documents if the price could be reduced to 10 cents or less. Resistance to the new technology was rational, identifying a disruptive technology in its early stages, when it is inferior and more expensive than the conventional alternative, takes unusual imagination. Similarly, there was a hidden demand for highly complex automated trading strategies that reached its full extent only when the tools were ready. What drove this cultural change? One common explanation might be called pathological. Progressive critics of Wall Street see an epidemic of greed and materialism and the resurgence of the arrogance of billionaires in an alleged new Gilded Age. It is not hard to find extreme avarice in American and world society, but that is hardly an explanation. As Philippon observed, the capitalists of 1910, while ruthless suppressors of workers' strikes, actually spent far less on financial intermediation than their successors do now. On the other side, many of the players in the derivatives market include what remains of the pension fund socialism that Peter Drucker predicted, acting not for moguls, but for participants in public and corporate retirement plans, seeking the highest possible returns while controlling risk, and thereby sometimes increasing risk and jeopardizing returns. Some of their clients may be billionaires, but they are also trying to get the best deal for the pooled funds of the 99%. Most of us participate at least indirectly in the algorithm-driven market. So far, we have derived enormous benefits from another side of electronic efficiency: index funds that maintain portfolios tracking common measures of securities markets, like the Standard & Poor's 500 and the Wilshire 5000 Total Market Index. Repeated studies show that no active human portfolio manager can equal returns on indexes, partly because almost no managers are consistently right in the long run, and partly because management expenses are far lower without trading commissions or high-salaried analysts. The Pennsylvania-based Vanguard Group, whose founder, John Bogle, introduced index funding in 1976 with the encouragement of the Nobel laureate economist Paul Samuelson, has been at the forefront of indexing. On Vanguard's blog, one of the company's analysts has described the concept as a monster of efficiency, citing continuous reductions in management fees over the past 40 years. Indexing may be, in his view, the best chance to reverse the growth in financial overheads highlighted by Philippon. But as indexing continues to grow in popularity, it also has become important enough, with over 30% of stocks and bonds under management, to feed back on the market itself. Companies included in indexes like the S&P 500 have higher valuations related to performance than others in the same industry that are not on the index. So, if the proportion of assets managed by index funds and robotic trading rises, it is still possible that their scale may influence markets in unexpected ways. In fact, some critics have warned that by reducing the number of active analysts in the name of efficiency, indexed investments are endangering the quality of the information on companies' prospects that securities prices are supposed to provide. A minority of economists and management scholars have been studying the values behind the algorithm-driven market. They see a deep shift in economic attitudes, one that can be elusive because it reflects quiet assumptions rather than ideologies. Paul H. Dembinski sees two 20th-century trends behind the rise of what he calls financialization. This means not only the growth of the financial services sector, but the belief in financial measurements as the key to the success of a society. Two modern forces are behind financialization, he argues. One is the efficiency ethos, the idea that productivity is the ultimate measure of good. The other is risk management, the system of protecting financial assets through instruments that limit possible losses at an acceptable cost. Efficiency and risk management are united by modern portfolio theory, for which the economist Harry Markowitz shared the Economics Nobel Prize in 1990. Well before that year, before the rise of modern networked computing, Dembinski argues, Markowitz and others helped create a new kind of economic actor, Homo financiarius, concerned not with agriculture or manufacturing, but with the optimal disposition of temporarily idle liquid savings under uncertainty using, as Markowitz put it in 1990, sufficient computer and database resources, usually available only to institutions. The ethics of efficiency meant that fiduciaries controlling stock in public companies had a duty to support a change in management that raised shareholder assets, no matter what the long-term effect on a company's employees, customers, or communities. Meanwhile, the economist Gerald F. Davis sees the rise of finance as nothing less than a transformation of American selfhood as well as of business institutions. While he does not use the word financialization, he, like Dembinski, sees the hegemony of the financial sector as the driving force of the economy. The transformation goes beyond the growth of the service economy that flourished as industrial productivity drove down the cost of manufactured goods, increasing disposable income. The rise of finance is tied to a new way of looking at life as a portfolio, not just of conventional financial assets, but of personhood and relationships, human capital for our education and abilities, and social capital for our network of family members and friends. In the portfolio society, as Davis describes it, people may know little or nothing about the underlying assets held in trust for them by intermediaries like banks and mutual fund companies. Thanks to the efficiency of personal computers and the web, it is possible for an individual to survey all his or her assets and liabilities in a single view, from bank accounts and securities through credit card statements and mortgage balances. In fact, this information can be downloaded and displayed graphically wherever there is Wi-Fi or cellular telephone service. We might say, paraphrasing Descartes, "I monitor and transact, therefore I am." Publicity about tools for the managed life obscures an alarming underside of personal finances. Most Americans, according to a survey released in early 2017, live from paycheck to paycheck. 63% of all households, and even a majority of Americans earning over $75,000 a year, lack cash reserves for a $500 emergency. While there are apps for encouraging savings, it may be that the net effect of our abundance of financial information gives us only an illusion of control. There is one final defense of financialization arising from the legendary fortunes of Silicon Valley. It may be harsh on underperforming corporations and their executives, but it mobilizes capital for transformative new ventures, and it encourages the emergence of innovators challenging established corporations. In fact, high technology entrepreneurship continued vigorously through and after the 2008 recession. As the economics and technology writer James Surowiecki has reported, the number of Silicon Valley companies receiving initial support from investors doubled from 2007 to 2012, and a total of $238 billion in venture capital was invested from 2010 to 2015, partly thanks to new technological tools. There are signs, though, that the golden age of startups is over. Early in the web era, it appeared that individuals and small partnerships could compete with giant corporations, and indeed many could, if only because implementing new systems in large organizations took time. 20 years later, the advantage appears to have shifted back to big business. The number of Americans working for big companies has been increasing, not declining. Concentration is especially apparent in platform enterprises like social media. A recent study by economists at MIT determined that while more technology companies than ever have been launched recently, fewer of them are succeeding. In social media, even a previously strong competitor with an elite user base, LinkedIn, was almost forced by declining share prices to be acquired by Microsoft in 2016. Twitter's stock price is weak, despite its own excellent demographics and its possible role in helping decide the 2016 election. It may be that in the battle for attention online, there is room for only one profitable platform in each category. One exception is the search engine Bing, still overshadowed by Google, but a profit center for Microsoft. In itself, bigness is not opposed to efficiency. It may be bad for equality and bad for democracy, but in the continuous process era, it often created genuine economies of